Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're ignited by Athlinks. We're also brought to you by RunCatalina.com, the Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com, or you can subscribe on iTunes. We're going to chat a little bit now about the Blueprint for Athletes Leadville 100 Mountain Bike Race. One of our favorite people, Mr. One-Arm Willie Stewart, joins us from his secret training hideout up in Boise, Idaho. Willie, how the heck are you?
I'm always good, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, bud. So for our listeners who might not know, and I can't believe anybody doesn't know the ballad of Willie Stewart, but we're talking a wrestler, we're talking a football player, out of high school, working at the Watergate building, and next thing you know, you're a one-arm guy.
Yeah, in the gutter, the low part of life, instant. High part of life a couple weeks before, low part of life a couple weeks later.
I mean, so you had just graduated high school, you were going to, what, wrestling scholarship?
Yeah, I was a good wrestler, pretty good football player, mostly wrestling, though. I was undefeated state champion wrestler. I grew up in the Mid-Atlantic area,
yeah.
So I was going to probably wrestle, but you never know what's going to go on. I mean, the hope was that I'd wrestle. I was undefeated at 18 years old, and here I was a month out of high school with my arm chopped off above the elbow.
And that was, you were working in a construction site at the Watergate Hotel and ended up, what were you, in an air conditioning duct or something?
Yeah, well, I'll give it the short version,
yeah.
Not too dramatic, but my arm was tied into a rope, and the rope went right through a cooling tower, and my head was either the head or the arm. And I've always said, much to the chagrin of many, it was the arm. And then, I fell to the ground. I knew I was hurt pretty bad, and I looked over in front of me, and I saw an arm laying there on the ground. And I looked down to my left, and I saw that it was my arm laying on the ground. And I thought I was done. And I was bleeding pretty bad, but it stopped pretty fast. I got my other hand on it, stopped the bleeding. And then I handed my old arm off to a guy, and I got down 15 stories by a crane, lowered me to the ground, and then I ran about a mile and a half to George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C.
So you basically ran to the hospital?
Right down the middle of rush hour traffic on a Friday morning in Washington, D.C.
I can imagine a look on the faces of some of those drivers.
Yeah, actually, I do. I will never forget that face.
Wow.
I mean, I'll never forget the ones that I looked, because I looked in, and I had, well, you know, you're hunkered over, holding your arm. You look like you just got shot.
Right.
Covered with blood. But I knew I was gone, and there was rush hour traffic, and I knew the ambulances were way behind me at that time.
So there was no way, if you had to wait for an ambulance, you might have bled out.
Yeah, it would have taken a long time, and all I wanted to do was get in the hospital, and I want someone to put something in me to make me go to sleep fast.
So when you get to the hospital, you've got a lot of kids in your family. Your parents come to see you. How hard was that for you and your parents to deal with this?
Oh, that was a brutal chapter in life. I mean, remember when I'm running into the hospital, my brother had already called my father, who only worked a couple of blocks away from there, and I was by myself running into the hospital without a limb, and the person I ran into on the way into the emergency room was my father.
Wow.
So, and then after that, I mean, remember, back then, this is a long time ago, this is before CAF, back then when you got disabled or an injury or life-changing incident like that, you thought that you were no good. And that's how I felt. That didn't last long, and then it was a battle to come back. And nowadays, with CAF, that battle doesn't really exist. The battle is an individual fight
right.
to come back, but you have resources now that never existed back when I got hurt. I mean, I meet kids all the time, you know, 6 months out of the hospital, and they're trying on a new limb to run a race or train for something or compete again. And there's, you know, the beauty of CAF. I mean, Challenge Athletes Foundation didn't exist, and I don't even know if CAF knows what they do anymore, but it is amazing when someone gets hurt. I got a phone call here in Boise the other day, a young probably about 12-year-old kid, hurt, yeah. spinal cord injury, high-level injury. He connected to the CAF website. They're still in the hospital.
Right.
Family connected to the website in the hospital, and it just gave him hope. And hope is powerful. And that family, I said, believe me, when the kid's ready and the mom and dad are ready, CAF is ready. And that exists. And just know that this resource exists. But 35 years ago, almost to the day, 35 years ago, it didn't. And it was a tough time for my family and myself.
So while you're in the hospital, was there a tough love part that came from mom and dad? Like, okay, this is not optimal, but you got to move on?
Yeah, my mom was pretty tough. I mean, eight kids. When you have eight kids, you better be tough.
Yeah.
Six boys.
Wow.
But I remember in the hospital, I flicked an orange over to her, and she caught it and flicked it, you know, because I said, hey, could you peel this for me? And she said, you peel it, threw it back.
Yeah.
And then that kind of let me know exactly the way I needed to think. I mean, it's a small thing, but you peel it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And I remember she didn't want to hear me say I couldn't do it.
I remember you telling me that when you were a rugby player before, you came back after this and felt that you were a better rugby player, or at least you could catch better with one arm than you caught with two arms. And how much anger did you bring to the table when you went out in the rugby field?
Well, in the words, I think it's Sex Pistols, anger is a great energy.
Yeah,
and but when I came back, I was stronger, faster. I was way better than I ever was, and I was way meaner than I ever was. But I felt like nobody believed that I could do it. And then when I came back, the first tournament I played in, I was the man of the match. I was the MVP. And that was 2 years of laying and down low, and then another year after the two, coming back training, and then on the third year, basically, coming back and winning an MVP of a tournament, the first one I played in.
You mentioned that there weren't a lot of opportunities, or at least wasn't a lot of awareness or what was out there for people with disabilities and challenges. How long did it take you to find that you were an endurance athlete, right? Cross-country skiing, running, triathlon. It was a little bit of hit and miss for you?
Well, when I think I was about 26, I was playing rugby still, and I was training in Colorado. I was doing a lot of alpine skiing, so I was using cross-country skiing to train. And they saw me training and said, well, hey, why don't you ever try out for the team? I'm like, tell me about the team. And they said, well, if you make this team, the U.S. Disabled Ski Team, you're part of the U.S. Ski Team, and you'll ski all over the world. And I said, well, that's not that hard for me. What do I need to do? So I took a VO2 max test and then came back in a year after what they told me to do training. I took the test again. I pegged it. You know, I was pretty high on the charts, and they knew I could ski fairly well, but you have to have a great engine, and I had that great engine. And so next thing I know, for 10 years, I was skiing all over the world. And that's when I won a silver medal in the 2002 Paralympic cross-country skiing.
And then you get into running, and you won the Catalina Marathon. You do the Ironman Triathlon, and people don't realize that when you first started doing the Ironman, it's not like you had a prosthetic arm. You were riding with one arm.
I was playing rugby, I was skiing, and I was doing Ironman as cross-training.
Right.
And I didn't have a prosthetic. I didn't have a prosthetic, and I jumped in Ironman. And it was a tough time. I mean, wind blowing 60. I think the year I got Ironman Age Group Athlete of the Year, because it was blowing 60.
Yeah.
And people were just getting knocked all over the place. And I had a pretty good race. You know, it wasn't my best time, but nobody had a good time that year. But I had a good race.
Well, the part that always...
For me, I was impressed with myself on that one.
Well, you should be, because the reality is, people think, okay, I'm riding along, and yeah, I have to white knuckle it a little bit, but I'm going to grab a water bottle every 5 miles. You couldn't take your hand off a handlebar and grab a water bottle.
For 112 miles.
For 112. So basically, you had like a reservoir. You were carrying how much poundage in water underneath your seat. I tell people this all the time. Willie was carrying like 10 extra pounds of water.
Dude, it was before Camelbacks. I mean, it looked like a gallon drum.
Exactly.
And then, well, to get the water out, you had to have a hydraulic pump. It was embarrassing.
I love that.
That's what I had.
Well, and that's what you did. So when was the first time, because you've done, you know, you've done Xterra World Championships, you've done a lot of different mountain biking, and you've done the blueprint for athletes, Leadville 100 mountain bike race a few times. When did you first get a prosthetic arm, and what type of difference did that make?
Well, you know, I got done with Ironman in Kona, and I met Tom from Xterra.
Yeah.
Founder, and yep. He said, what's it going to take you to get the Xterra? And I go, you get me a bike and I'll get an arm, and you got it. And I went back and I won the world championship a year later. And now, the reason I do Leadville so much now is because, you know, basically I became a born-again rider in, 2004 was the first time I ever put a prosthetic on.
Yeah.
So it was all a whole new game, and having a prosthetic, I was like, this is cheating.
I'm riding with two arms.
It was just unbelievable. And my crashes are glorious now. I mean, if I do crash, they're not pretty. But when it's working, it's pretty cool. And this will be my sixth Leadville, so.
Wow. And what is it about that, Remy? I mean, you're going from 10,000 up to 12,000, and there's single track, there's fire road, there's solid, there's regular road.
It's intense, Bob.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's so much. You start out going, 35, 40 miles an hour downhill when it's 30 degrees.
Going down with 2,000 athletes, going down, busting in from road, then to jeep road, then to double track, then to single track. And it's basically a scramble for position for the first 4 miles. And you can't sit back. I mean, so a lot of people hit the deck right out of the gate. But it's a it's an electric, fantastic race. It's one of those things that, it is like Kona when the gun goes off.
Yeah.
Leadville has that exact same deal. It's intense. It's an overpowering experience, and it's just so much going on. And if you're a good rider and you're in the back, I think it was Jimmy Rigatello a couple of years ago. He started in the back, and he's worked his way up through. Huddle had to work his way through. Everyone has to start in the back.
Right.
And work your way up.
So talk about what it means to you to be able to be an athlete still. I mean, it's funny because we look at it now and it seems like a natural thing. But when you first found out that you could still be an athlete, okay, you lost your arm, but you were still Willie Stewart. How important was that? And just the, like you said, hope and just the ability to still be in the game.
Yeah, that was the thing, because I didn't believe, you know, it's a really, now, I mean, I tell everyone you have to believe, but I didn't believe that I'd ever be back.
Yeah.
And then I remember just the first time towing the line with a number on, how transforming that, it wasn't because I was fast, I wasn't anything, I could have been last, but the fact that I was back in the game, and then I built on that, and I think a lot of my self-esteem and confidence came flowing back through sport, and if that's in our DNA and in the character of a kid growing up, which that was me, and then that's taken away from you, I mean, it's hard to explain to someone how important that is if you've never had it taken away from you. But if you've had it taken away from you, it's the down low, lowest feeling you'll ever have.
So when you do something like the Blueprint for Athletes Leadville 100 mountain bike race, and there's obviously everybody's struggling, it's a level playing field, doesn't matter if you're missing an arm, a leg, just able-bodied guy, right? It's an equal opportunity abuser. When you're out there and you're passing some guy who's got two arms, do you get looks? Do you get people going, you know, just cheering you on? What do you get out there?
My fellow athletes, how I like to look at everyone, but it's a great support system. I mean, I probably have never had such great feelings as I do in long distance or endurance racing, and seeing so many people over so many hours saying, hey, man, you motivate me, or go for it, and that puts me in perspective. Or, it's just, if I can be motivated by other athletes, and I do myself personally get motivated by disabled athletes too, watching people overcome things. And so at Leadville, I mean, the crowd is fantastic. It's a mountain bike scene. It's a little hectic, but once it gets rolling, the course itself will humble most everyone. I mean, there's going to be maybe 10, 15 people that go out there and crush it, you know, those top guys and girls. But the rest of us are just getting through it.
The thing that always that interests me about this race, I mean, when you go to Hawaii, you know it's going to be hot. And once it gets hot, it's going to stay hot. When you do this race, it could be 30 degrees at the start. And I'm sure it probably gets up into the 70s and 80s at some point. It could be hailing, could be anything.
No.
How do you prepare for everything that this thing's going to deal to you?
Yeah, you're allowed. I do put, when we get up to the big climbs at Columbine, which goes up to almost 13,000 feet, I have in that pack, I'll have a lot of backup stuff. But the first year I did, this is a while ago, but I did it, and coming back is when it started snowing. And, I mean, once it starts snowing, I don't know, you're cold, and you're coming down some incredibly fast descents. I mean, they're big, big, fast descents coming down from 12,000 feet. It gets cold. So you got to carry, you know, you're carrying a glove, a baklava, a jacket. You got your knee warmers, a lot of stuff. We're going in and out of your little backpacks to carry them. They like to rag on people carrying backpacks, but I'm kind of going Bob Babbitt style when you do the blue plate special
and everything. Exactly. Carry it all.
You got the boombox.
So here's a guy who, you've done the Ironman. Like you said, you won World Championship at Xterra. You've won the Catalina Marathon. You've done Leadville. You said this is your seventh time going for Leadville.
This will be my sixth.
Sixth time.
Trying to get the big belt buckle. You get a big body buckle for 10.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for. Because I need that, or I won't feel whole.
You won't have your you won't be able to hold your pants up.
That's right.
What type of time are you looking for?
You know what? I have a lot of excuses why I won't have a good time, so I probably will have a good one. But, you know, I always try to do around nine hours. Yeah. If I do sub 9, I'm happy as can be. If I do sub 12, I'm happy as can be. A lot of times, I'm just looking to get it done. I mean, I can go out there and I can bust my tail out to Columbine, make the turnaround, come down, get it 60, and it's only 40 miles left, but that's the longest 40 of your life. So,
what's your favorite moment from Leadville?
I think it was that first year, and they didn't think I could even do it, and I about mile 30, I didn't think I could do it, and the clock was counting down. It was 11 hours and 57 minutes, I think, and I came through. I had 3 minutes to make the cutoff, and I made it.
Wow.
And then since then, I've shaved a few hours, but that first year was tough, and it snowed that year, and the course was way more beat up back then, and
you made it.
Yeah, that's what I want to do first. Oh, it's just like Ironman. You know, what's the cutoff at Ironman? 16 hours?
17, yeah. You just want to, And anything else is gravy, right? Everything else is gravy.
Right. Give me that. I can walk a marathon backwards if that's what it takes. I'm not going to quit.
Toughest thing you've done, was it the kayaking the Grand Canyon?
Yeah, the Grand Canyon, main reason that was the toughest because the amount of times I almost died.
That when you almost die, that usually, because you know when you do Ironman, no matter what happens, and even Leadville, you're going to end up with, in Kona, you're going to end up with a drink with an umbrella in it sometime before midnight.
Yeah.
In Leadville, you're going to have a beer sometime before, you know, before 12 hours.
Yeah. But the death move, the death in the Grand Canyon was pretty tough. That was 20-something days of just getting pounded. And by the end of the Grand Canyon, I was pretty good, but at the top of it, I thought I was good.
And that's one of those things, the good news, bad news type of deal, because the good news is the prosthetic arm makes you a better paddler.
Yeah.
The bad news is when you get flipped out of the boat and the prosthetic arm gets lodged in the rock underwater, you can die.
Yeah, I lost a $20,000 kayaking, you know, it's a solo boat, kayaking prosthetic at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Luckily, I mean, who has a spare arm? But right. I had a spare arm with me.
Wow.
So I kept one in the front of the boat, like packed way in there, and I had it, and it worked. I mean, I put it together with shoestrings and some duct tape, but it worked, and I paddled another, it was 240 miles of kayaking through big, big, big dangerous stuff.
But there must have been a point when this arm is suctioned on your arm, and it's stuck in the bottom, it's stuck in the rocks, and you're submerged. Was there a point where you thought, this is it?
Yeah, that was almost a daily event, but that one was the one that was done. And because the arms, I don't know, a lot of people don't, I mean, how many people get a chance to take off a prosthetic? But if they're under pressure, one's never been under that kind of pressure before, but when they're under pressure, they don't release. And because the river was running so huge, and I was so deep down, and I was lodged, it wouldn't release. I couldn't get it off, and there's not much I could do about it. But the river's, it just did a big shock all of a sudden, and bam, I was up. But it was about 2.5 minutes before I was up.
Wow.
And then the wonder why I drink and have PTSD, it's from that moment. I'll tell you that.
I bet you it is. I bet you it is. I love that. Willie, thank you so much for taking time. Thanks for everything you do for Challenged Athletes Foundation. You, my friend, are a total legend. You'll be going for your sixth Blueprint for Athletes Leadville 100 mountain bike finish this coming weekend. Then you'll only be four more till the big buckle.
That's right. And that's the big buckle is when I finally can feel that I'm one again with the universe.
I love that.
I need that big buckle, Bob.
You got to have the big buckle. It's all about the big buckle. Again, my name is Bob Babbitt. This is Babbittville Radio. We are ignited by Athlinks. We're also brought to you by RunCatalina.com. Challenged Athletes Foundation. Willie is one of our spokespeople. And we've raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. Please subscribe on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We'll be right back.